WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. One of this summer's more interesting movie performances is given by Samuel Jackson in Jungle Fever. The judges at the Cannes Film Festival liked Jackson's performance so much, they gave him a special award for Best Supporting Actor. Jackson is a former member of the Negro Ensemble Company and has had small roles in many films. This is Jackson's third film, directed by Spike Lee. You may remember him in Do the Right Thing as the radio DJ, Mr. Senior Love Daddy. But that cool character is very different from the out-of-control crack addict he plays in Jungle Fever. Jackson's character, Gator, is driven by his addiction. The only relationship he has left with his architect brother Flipper, played by Wesley Snipes, and with his parents, played by Ossie Davis and Ruby Dee, is pleading for money, which he knows they don't want to give him. So he tries to wear them down.
Oh, look at here. I'm a little light, though.
What, you didn't get your check from Soul Train yet?
You know, Don lost my address. Come on, hit me. Get some cash in my hand.
Gator does his dance when he asks anyone in his family for money. I asked Samuel Jackson the story behind this dance.
Well, actually, it's written in the script. That was Spike's idea, but I had to make up the dances. I judge by the way that I used to do things at my house. When my mom had her friends over, they would always call me in to do the new dances for them. And there would be older ladies sitting there watching you do the twist or the jerk or something.
Right.
Talking about how that would ruin their back if they did it.
That's right.
And it was a form of acceptance and performance that always garnered you praise and sometimes, you know, monetary recompense of some sort. You know, the ladies would give you quarters, dimes, whatever. And I'm sure that his mother did that very same thing. And they danced together. And he used the same tactics to entertain Flipper, played by Wesley Snipes, when he was younger, too, to placate him and to get things out of him. So he uses that. It seems to be something he knows that works, and that's what he uses.
Do you know people who are crack addicted, or have you run into a lot of people on the street who are?
Yes, I have, and I do, and I did. All of those. I knew people who were addicted, I know people who are addicted, and I know people who are in recovery, and all of that. And in talking to them and talking to drug counselors, I discovered that using drugs usually cuts off your emotional growth. So I stopped Gator's emotional growth at about 16. So that when he reacts to things, he reacts to things as a 16-year-old. He wants what he wants when he wants it, kind of like a baby. And in doing that, it leads to a certain amount of vulnerability and not having a lot of coping skills in the world. So he reverts to that dance and begging rather than his own wiles.
Did your part in Jungle Fever give you a new understanding for our empathy with addicts?
Well, I always had that. I had a roommate who was a heroin addict in college. I've always had friends who were involved in drug trade or in an addicted state. Even in my early, my formative years, I knew those people because I lived in a neighborhood in Tennessee that was kind of an alcoholic neighborhood. So it was the drug of the day was alcohol at that period. And we had a neighborhood drunk. There were lots of people in my neighborhood who sold bootleg liquor. So I saw people who were drunk all the time. That was another kind of addiction. And I had friends who drank from an early age throughout school. And then I knew people who did pills when it was time to do pills. And I guess during the 60s, I did all the things that all the people of my generation did during the 60s. So I had my own drug experiences at that time with marijuana and all the other things that passed through that era. And you just outgrow them. I did, but some people don't.
There's a very grim scene in a shooting gallery.
No, crack house.
In a crack house, I'm sorry.
Big difference.
Yeah, big difference. You're right. would you describe how the scene was set up? What it was like to shoot that? It's a very moody scene.
It was hot. It was hot and crowded in there. They had 500 extras that day. And they had people dressed in all kinds of professional attire and non-professional attire. There were doctors, lawyers, construction workers, nurses, store owners, mothers, fathers, teenagers, old people. There were all kinds of people in there just to depict the fact that crack is touching every strata of our society. And they pumped a lot of smoke in that room. They passed out a lot of stems. It was noisy in there. It was real, real hot. A lot of the extras, when you have that many extras on a set, all of them are trying to get into the camera shot. So it added to the chaos of the room because everybody wanted to be seen. So it was kind of like a crack house in that instance that there's a lot of activity. Most of the activity centered around those pipes. Because when you're in a situation like that, everybody's watching that pipe to make sure nobody gets a bigger hit than the next person. Everybody's trying to buy their own or hold on to some for themselves. And by the focal point of the scene being Holly and myself sitting there on that mattress, everybody was trying to get close to us so they could get in that shot. So, you know, tension was pretty high in there. And I think it all paid off in the long run just watching how the scene worked.
You know, everybody likes to do things for research. Did you feel like you should go to a crack house for research?
I felt like that, yeah. But I didn't have to. I felt like I should, but I really didn't have to. I've been in enough rooms with a lot of people getting high that it's all the same thing. The focus is always the drug and not the other people in there, you know. But the big difference being back in the 60s when everybody sat around and smoked marijuana, everybody got philosophical and had the answers to the problems of the world. When you're sitting around smoking crack or freebase cocaine, the whole focus is on that pipe and there is no conversation. It's not a friendly situation.
You've done several films with Spike Lee. How did you first start to work with him?
School Days was my first Spike Lee film. Was it? Yeah. Yeah, School Days was my first film. I was doing a soldier's play at the Negro Ensemble Company, and I was in the original company of that play. And Spike came by one day specifically to meet me because he knew a friend of mine, Monty Ross, his co-producer, and I worked together in college. And he came by to see me to tell me he had gone to Morehouse and he was going to make films. He was at NYU Film School. And he invited me to come down to watch some of the editing process of Joe's Bed-Stuy Barbershop, We Cut Heads. That was his graduation film, his graduate project. And I went down and we talked. He told me he was going to be a filmmaker and he was going to do these films. And when he got ready to do them, he wanted to work with me. And I agreed to that. And sure enough, when he was able to hire union actors, he hired me.
Do you think that there's a difference between your portrayal of Gator the crack addict in Jungle Fever and how you'd be expected to play that role or what you'd think of playing that role if it was in, say, a crime series on TV or a big budget action film? Do you know what I mean? Where you wouldn't be the main character, you'd just be like a sidebar character who's like the crack addict.
Well, you only get a chance to see addictive behavior in those kinds of films. I had a chance in this film to take Gator out of the stereotypical addict role, where you either see him nodding or being totally crazy. So you had a chance to get into Gator the person, Gator the human being, and not just Gator the junkie, someone you don't care about at all or have no feelings about one way or another. Most of the time, those characters pass through films and they're props more than anything else. And since Spike was accused of not addressing the drug issue in any of his other films, I guess he attacked it with a vengeance this time and made sure that there were things going on.
Have you had to play more generic kind of roles in TV or in movies? You know,
Yeah, well, I've been cast as Black Man in Sea of Love. That was my name. No, it was Black Guy in Sea of Love. That was the character name.
Is that what it said in the credits?
That's what it says in the credits, Black Guy. So I guess you could say I have. But I always try to make those characters memorable. People always remember me from the things that I do. It's back to my friends calling me King of the Cameos because I pass through films and kind of leave my impression. They always remember me.
If you're just joining us, my guest is actor Samuel Jackson, and he stars as Gator, the crack addict, in the new film Jungle Fever. We're going to take a short break, then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Actor Samuel Jackson is my guest. He stars as Gator in the film Jungle Fever. Now, didn't you spend a couple of years on TV as Bill Cosby's stand-in?
Not on TV, actually.
That's right.
I got to do
on the set.
Yeah, on the set. We had a whole stand-in family, and we would go in and... Actually, we did. We were the junior Huxtables, I guess. And we would watch them rehearse the show right down the blocking, which is the way they move around the set. And on Wednesdays in the mornings, we would go in and actually do the whole show the way they did it so that they could plot out their camera shots and camera moves. And I wore Bill's clothes over my clothes because he's larger than I am so that the lights would be correct and they could get their color palette down. And I did that for 2.5 years, actually, and never got on the show. Well, actually, I did. Every time they show an exterior shot of people walking down the street outside their house, that's me and this other girl who was a stand-in, and we walked past each other. That's the only time I was ever on that show.
So as the stand-in for Cosby, you must have spent a lot of time sitting on the couch making jokes and being wise.
Yeah.
That's kind of how he spends the show.
Yeah. I imitated him quite well. So I did that for a while. And it was fun. It was kind of like taking a how to act on TV course for free and being paid at the same time.
So did this lead to any breaks? Did anybody offer to help you from the series?
Help me do what?
An on-camera gig.
No, that was always the thing that was kind of dangled to us to keep us coming back to do that job. You know, there's always a possibility you'll get on the show. I never worried about that, really. I was just there to do that while I wasn't doing anything else. And when it was time for me to do other things, I just went on and did them. I didn't wait for my big break on The Cosby Show because I really didn't realistically think that was going to happen, and it didn't. And I don't know anybody who's done that job who's ever actually gotten on the show. And I know people who've been there for a while, and I know people who've moved on and done other things who never got on there either. So it's kind of like the same thing. Actors always get stuff like that. People ask you to do off-Broadway shows and tell you, well, you know, they're actually thinking about moving this show. You know, everybody says that. You know, sure, the show's coming to Broadway in 1995, maybe. So you take your chances. I don't particularly believe anything until I sign a contract. I learned that early in the game. I sign a contract, I believe anything you say. Till then, it's all speculation.
Now, in Spike Lee's movie School Days, you mm-hmm. played a townie who was really hostile to the students
right.
who had arrived from out of town.
Leeds. He had a name. Leeds, L-E-E-D-S.
Thank you.
Yes.
But you yourself were not a townie. You were a college student and went... Went to...
Did you say colored or college? What did you say?
College.
Oh, okay.
You were a college student.
I'm just kidding.
Oh.
All right.
Yeah, you were a colored student.
Yes.
Yeah. No,
Okay, but back to your question. Yes, I was not a townie. No, I was not a townie. Yes, I went to Morehouse.
Yes.
Spike cast me in that role specifically because for a long time, my freshman year in college, this was before Spike's time, but I think Bill Nunn told him about it, the fellow who played Radio Raheem.
Yeah.
Well, Billy's a good friend of mine. But my freshman year at Morehouse, I actually hung out with the Block Boys. That was what we called them, not townies, but Block Boys. I actually hung out with them, and they didn't know that I went to college for about 6 months.
Oh, were you hiding that from them?
Not really, but I used to be with them when they were robbing college students and beating them up. And so they didn't really know I was one of them until they saw me at a dance one night and I had on some Morehouse gear or something. They're like, you go to Slim, you actually go to college? It's like, yeah. And it kind of changed their image of the Morehouse guys, and they didn't beat them up so often.
Oh, so you were really performing the role of Good Samaritan here.
That wasn't my purpose. Actually, what happened was when I got to college, my mom dropped me off there and I saw a basketball court up the street, and I played basketball a lot then. And I went up to the basketball court and I bought a quart of beer, and I asked who was up next, and I played with them, and they just assumed that I had moved in the neighborhood because I was there every day and a long time, most of the day, and they just assumed I was one of them. And I hung out with them like I was.
So what kinds of things would they say about the college students?
Well, they were stuck up. They were what they called sadiddy. They actually thought, well, a lot of them did think they were better than, and we were taught that we were better than also by the administration of the school. We were told that we were the top in the top 10% of the black race who was going to lead everybody out of darkness into the light, and that Morehouse men were, at that time, something like 75% of all the doctors in America were Morehouse men, and the Morehouse men were publishers, editors. They were the leaders of the race. So a lot of them really believed that, and they didn't speak to them. The guys would just say hello, and they wouldn't speak back. And that would be cause for a beating or another attitude to flare up, or they would run them back to campus, mainly because they wouldn't speak. They ignored those people who lived in the community. Like, they invaded these people's community and felt that they were there to run it. And that wasn't the truth.
Were you ever in the position where you were with your friends and they were robbing a college student who you happened to know?
Yeah.
So what happened?
Nothing. He looked at me, and before he could say anything, somebody hit him. And by that time, they took his stuff, and we left. And as a result of that, I ended up in the dean's office because the guy did recognize me, and he did report the robbery and did say that I was with him. And as a consequence of that, I was put on probation a few times because I refused to identify the people who did it.
Right. Did it ever bother you that they were doing that?
No.
Why not?
Because they were... Actually, well, 90% of the time, they were correct, and the person that they were taking the stuff from could afford to have it taken. And they were people with petty bourgeois ideas who needed a lesson like that in reality.
Now, speaking of petty bourgeois, now I understand that when you were in college, that you were one of the people who held some of the trustees hostage.
Yeah.
So what were the issues?
The issues were that there weren't any student representatives on the trustee board. There weren't any community representatives because we were right in the middle of this community, and these people should have a say in what kinds of things go on around them. There weren't enough black faculty members. We wanted more black studies because there weren't any at the school. We were trying to change some of the policies. And Charles Merrill, who was the head of the trustee board at that time, told him we were absolutely correct. But it was these, quote-unquote, men who were trying to make us these perfect Negroes who thought we were upsetting their apple cart. And they told us that we were the kinds of people that they never should have let in Morehouse in the first place. We were more or less an experiment in the kinds of people that they let in when my class came in. And we turned out to be just what they thought.
So did your radical politics go along with a radical sense of theater at the time?
Yeah. Well, no, I wasn't even doing theater then.
Oh.
Actually, I was just a student.
So you can't call this guerrilla theater then?
Well, that didn't happen until I came back to school in 71, second semester of 71. And that's when I started my theater major in earnest. And aside from the Morehouse Spelman Players, which was our proper theater in school where we did all our school productions, we had our own theater company, the Black Image Theater Company. That was our Hate Whitey Revolutionary Theater. But we did all those kinds of revolutionary poems and skits about the supremacists. We had like a singing group that was like the Supremes, but we were called the Supremacists, and we sang racist tunes. And we did all those Die Nigger poems so black folk can take over, you know, New Nation poems. And people were paying us to do that stuff. We were traveling all over. We were going to Tulane and Florida State and all kinds of big white schools. And they were like, yes, yes, denigrate us, denigrate us. Yes, do it, do it. And we enjoyed it. It was great fun.
What led you out of the radical period, the radical theater period?
What led me out of it? I didn't have time to do it anymore. And then times changed. People became very apathetic. Mm-hmm. Everybody was out trying to make a buck, and nobody was real concerned. I mean, black power just died for some reason. I don't know what it was. I guess it was oversaturation or whatever. But when people stopped wearing afros and wearing dashikis and nationalism didn't become so fashionable, then that theater changed into more or less of a mainstream type of thing. The Black Image Theater started to do scripted plays that was still about, by, for, and about black people, but it wasn't that, you know, Die Whitey or Hate Whitey theater. It was more about the black human condition.
This may sound like an odd question, but this summer has been, like, a terrific summer for young black directors and actors.
Yes.
And I'm thinking, you know, that so many of these new directors are really pretty young, and a lot of the actors who they're casting are pretty young too. Mm-hmm. I'm wondering if you think that there'll be room for actors who are, gosh, already in their 40s. You know what I mean?
Like me?
Yeah, right, in the newer movies. You know, it's like, it's really great, but...
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think so. I don't know. It's not vanity, but folks always say, it's hard to believe that I'm 42 years old. But I am, and I have a 42-year-old sensibility, but I also have that other sensibility, too, because I hang out with younger people. But this will give me a chance to do the kinds of things that I've never been able to do. By being able to work with these younger directors, I'll be able to play a father who has a father's sensibilities, because I am a father. And I'll be able to play somebody's mentor, possibly, because I haven't been able to do that. So I think I'll be able to work with these kids. And a lot of them I know.
Uh-huh.
And I've met most of them anyway. I met John Singleton when they had the premiere for Jungle Fever, and he expressed an interest in working with me, and I expressed one working with him. I know Bobby Townsend from when he was running around here being a stand-up comedian,
right,
and an actor before he became Bobby Townsend. So I know him. I know Spike. I know Kevin Hooks. I just worked with Kevin. I know so many of these directors, and I think that my work will speak for itself, and that if they really want a good actor to do something, then they'll ask me to do some of those things that 40-year-old people do in their films. They won't all be so teen-oriented that I won't be able to do anything. I'll be the teacher at the school, the principal, whatever. Who knows, you know? I'll do something.
Well, Sam Jackson, I wish you the best. I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
Samuel Jackson co-stars in Jungle Fever. He plays Gator, a crack addict. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.